Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by VeloFix.com, by RunCatalina.com, by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by our Challenged Athletes Foundation. We have now sent out over 18,000 grants and raised over $83 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com or on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here. I am really excited for our next guest. In all the years we've been doing the show, we've never had the opportunity to speak to the woman who is really the reason that a lot of these races out there are 65% women. She is the first person to finish the Boston Marathon. Her name is Catherine Switzer. Catherine, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Bob. I really am. Hey, and you've got to make a little clarification there. I was the first woman to officially register.
Right. That's right. Bobby Gibb. Yep. Bobby ran it. That's
true. Yeah, absolutely. Bobby jumped out of the bushes the year before, ran the race. But I signed up for the race the next year, pinned on the bib, and that's what caused
all the ruckus.
Most amazing photograph in the history of running.
Well, you know what's so funny is when you think about it, the fact that there happened to be a photo truck right there when that happened is pretty amazing, because usually they'd be up, the photo truck would be up with the leaders of the race.
You know, Bob, I was joking with my coach immediately afterwards, and really quite disdainful of the organization of the Boston Marathon. For many years, I thought it was the most disorganized race imaginable. And, in fact, I used to say, all I have to do is do right what Boston does wrong, and I've got the dream race. And, in fact, it was a great design model for me when I started organizing women's races around the world. But here's what happens in those days, is they started the press truck behind the runners, as well as the bus that carried the officials and the timers, which is another lethal thing. You know, you'd never do that. But anyway, they would beep the horn and make everybody move over. And I thought, yipes, not only is this dangerous on narrow New England roads, but, you know, you could clip one of these elite runners when you pass them. And I mean, that's just a disaster. But anyway, what happened is they were coming through the field and they saw me, a woman wearing bib numbers, and behind the press truck was the bus with the officials on it. And so the press were taking pictures of me like crazy when the guys on the bus were teasing the race director and saying, hey, Jocko, there's a girl in your race and she's wearing bib numbers. And he was so infuriated, he jumped from that bus, ran after me and attacked me and tried to pull off my bib numbers, and, of course, did it in front of the press truck. So, I mean, his timing was terrible but also perfect.
Well, it was fascinating to me. So take me back. Growing up, what were your sports?
When I was growing up, when I was 12, I was entering high school early, and I was really insecure about it, and my dad thought that I should run a mile a day. Amazing. He said, if you ran a mile a day, you'd make this new team in your school called field hockey. And so I trained a mile a day all that summer, so when the fall began, I could try out for the field hockey team. And I really played well because I never got tired. And I could outrun everybody just because I ran this mile a day, so I was in pretty good shape. But I thought it was magic, and I kept running the mile a day, but I played other sports. So I played field hockey, basketball, and then just ran by myself in the spring and all through the summer. And I just I was really lucky that in my high school, back in the early 60s, they had teams for girls. I mean, that was amazing.
Really is,
so
yeah.
I was very, very privileged from that point of view. But it was the running that was the magic for me. It gave me that sense of empowerment that got me through high school, got me through all kinds of other challenges, got me, you know, to believe that I could do more than take on other things, you know, whether it was an advanced course or work on the student newspaper or whatever. And it was phenomenal for me. I knew also that there were going to be no team sports. I knew very little about the Olympics. I thought only people who go to the Olympics run sprints. That's all I had for a role model in the Olympics. And so I thought at least I could run by myself all the time and feel fit and healthy.
So back then, it's one thing to think about the marathon, but weren't there 5K and 10K races that were open to the public back then, or was that even before that?
I'd never heard of them.
Okay, so it's not like you had signed up for any. There weren't any races that people were. If there were, I can't imagine that the races back then, 5K, 10K, were just for men. But maybe they just weren't many.
What I did do, I joined the AAU, which was the governing body of sports in those days, and they had track and field. So at least I could run on the track. And so I did run 800, 400, 200, 400, 800, totally frustrated. But I'd never heard about a road race. The first road race I ever heard about was the Boston Marathon, and that's because when I was at a little college called Lynchburg College in Lynchburg, Virginia, this is before I went to Syracuse University.
Yeah.
One of the guys on the school track team had run the Boston Marathon. And when I heard that this thing was 26 miles long, I said, oh, my God, that's fantastic, you know. And I was saying, you know, I wish that girls could run the 2 mile because the guys had a 2 mile run. And basically, though, it was the cross country that they ran that fascinated me. And then when I heard about the Boston Marathon, wow, that was it. I just had to do that.
And at that point, you didn't know that it wasn't okay for women to sign up. So when you signed up as KV Switzer, you weren't trying to fool anybody. You were just registering for the event.
Well, that's exactly right. But I wasn't going to sign up for the race. It was my coach at Syracuse who insisted I sign up for the race. I knew I wasn't going to be the first because I knew that Roberta Gibb had run this. I didn't know at that time that other women had run marathons also. There had been, you know, probably six throughout history. But they were very, very unheralded, okay? So nobody had heard about them until we started writing this history about them. But anyway, I thought that Boston was just this big, open kind of circus race that anybody could go up and just enter, except for the guys in the front, you know, the elites. And so when I proved to my coach in practice at Syracuse that I could do the distance, he was very, very proud of me, and he said, now you have to sign up for the race. I said, well, why? And he said, because it's a serious race. You don't just do that. You know, you're a card-carrying member of the AAU. You know better than that. And I said, well, I didn't know it was a big deal. Okay, okay, okay. So we signed up for the race, but I signed my name KV Switzer. And when the entry form went in, they thought that it was from a guy. There was nothing, by the way, about gender on the entry form or even in the rule book.
Oh, interesting. So it's not like you check a box because they didn't know women were allowed.
Nope. Yeah, yeah, because nobody believed a woman could do it or would want to do it. So why even bother even thinking about it? I mean, it was just beyond their thinking. And so when I showed up with bibs, this race director, of course, thought that I was there being a clown and making a fool of him and demeaning his race and, you know, besmirching the reputation.
Sure.
He said, I should know that this is an all-men's event. Well, I knew it was an all-men's event, but I didn't know it had to be an all-men's event. It wasn't in the rule book. We checked the rule book in the entry form.
It didn't say anything. So while you're running along, and then the bus comes by, and you and Jock jumps out and tries to grab your number, and Thomas shoves him away, which was the classic photos, right, of Thomas pushing him. I have to imagine that at that point, you got to be freaked out. Here's somebody trying to shove you off the course.
Yeah,
how'd you hold it together for the rest of the run?
You know, we laugh about the incident now because my boyfriend, you know, decked the official. But
yeah.
But I was terrified. I mean, it was out of the blue. And up to that point, all the guys were wonderful to me, as they always had been in running, you know. Wish my wife would run, wish my girlfriend would run. We're with you all the way, go for it. All those wonderful motivating things that guys have always done for women in running. Not other sports, unfortunately, but running is unique that way. And so I was feeling great. I knew we were laughing and joking because, you know, we knew pretty soon it was going to feel pretty terrible. And all of a sudden, you know, with the press truck, we thought it was kind of funny. We just laughed and waved at him. And then all of a sudden comes, you know, Jock Semple and attacks me. I mean, it was just totally frightening. And it was like being in a bad dream, you know, where you're trying to get away from the monster and you can't because he had me by the shirt and was screaming, cursing at me. And my coach couldn't do anything. My coach kept screaming, leave her alone. She's okay, I've trained her. He just batted him away. So my boyfriend really took him out. And then my coach said, run like hell. And down the street we went.
So when you
but it was a turning point in my life.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I joke about it, but it was an absolute turning point in my life. And consequently, a turning point in the lives of millions of women. Who would have imagined it?
So what happens is people show that incident, and they show you getting shoved, and then you finish the race. And people forget it's still – this is 68? 67. It was still illegal, right? And what until what, 72 for women to sign up?
Well, you see, then they made it illegal.
Oh, so okay, so it wasn't illegal before
because
you guys didn't exist up until then.
Yeah, when I finished the race, I was met by these irascible journalists, and I was paranoid throughout the whole race because I thought that the official had gone ahead and told the police to pull me out of the race or something, which, by the way, he did. So it wasn't unfounded paranoia. I didn't know it for years, but when I went back and read, I was writing my book, Marathon Woman. I went back to all the boxes of newspaper clippings, which I kept, and I found that, and I thought, oh, my God. You know, because you kept coming to a corner, and there'd be a cop there, and you'd think, is he going to pull me? What's going to happen here? But anyway, after I finished the race, I was disqualified from the race, and I was expelled from the Amateur Athletic Union for running with men,
yes,
for running more than a mile and a half, for fraudulently entering the race, because I entered with my initials, even though men did. And the fourth reason, and the best, was I had run the Boston Marathon without a chaperone.
Oh, my God, without a chaperone. I love that. Well, wait, you did have a chaperone. You had Thomas.
I did. I had a whole team.
Yes.
Yeah, I had a whole team of chaperones. Anyway, the other thing is they then put men only. They said this in bold letters next year. This is a men's only event. And they came out with all these regulations and stories about how, you know, if women ran, that it was dangerous for them and I should know better. And I said, well, I'm 20 years old. Why do I need protecting from myself?
Right.
You know?
Yep.
It was really people believed for so long, thousands of years, and many countries still do, as we know, probably most countries still do, you know, believe not only in the limitation of women, and their physical weakness, but that we would actually damage ourselves and particularly our reproductive ability. Well, of course, you know, that's all designed to...
That's the most ridiculous thing.
Is it designed
ever.
To protect us? No, it's designed to restrain us.
And, yeah, yes.
Anyway, so he and they all couched these rules in a way that made it sound like, you know, you're so stupid, you don't know how to take care of yourself, and what you're doing is not only socially objectionable, but, you know, you're endangering, you know, the health of people. So,
and we need men to protect you. That's what we're here for. We need to protect you because you don't know any better. What I love is Will Cloney's line, women can't run in the marathon because the rules forbid it. If that girl was my daughter, I would spank her.
I know.
I love it.
At that point, that was the only time my mother went berserk.
Yes.
Up to that point, my mom was very calm. And my dad and said, okay, you know, I said, listen, they said, you know, we're getting calls from lawyers. What do you want to do? And I said, leave it alone. You know, he's just an irascible guy. He's trying to protect his race. I want to move women forward. I don't want to set them back. We have a lawsuit. It's going to be ugly. And even if I win, it'll be ugly because people will be resentful. And I said, I'm going to take the high road on this. I forgive him. You know, let's move on. But he didn't forgive me for many years. And when Will Cloney came out with that line, my mother went berserk.
I bet. Were there any media champions back then, or were all the media just older guys who...
No, there were two of them.
Okay.
It was really interesting. One of them became the dean of the Boston Marathon writing, of marathon writing in Boston, and that was Joe Concannon of the Boston Globe.
Yes.
It had been to that point Jerry Nason. And when I was getting interviewed at the finish line, all these guys were really, really tough on me. And boy, it's amazing. When I look back at my quotes in the paper, I gave as good as I got. It was really amazing. You know, being 20, I mean, how did I have the possibility to do
exactly.
That? But this guy was a young reporter, and he asked me really considered questions, and I realized he wasn't really much older than I was. And actually, it was his first assignment for the Boston Globe. And clearly all the other Globe writers had gone in and said, I'm not standing out in the rain for any 4 hours and 20 minutes waiting for a girl to finish. So they sent Joe out there, and he wrote a really nice story. And we became friends ever since, okay? The other one was Bud Collins, who is a wonderful wonderful, better known for tennis.
Yes.
Remember interviewing people.
And very, very cool jackets and stuff, right?
And wacky pants and wonderful personality. And he wrote an editorial for the, I think the one, the Herald or the Globe. And he said, "What I saw in the streets of Boston today was disgraceful. You know, that if we have to legislate, you know, women running, this is ridiculous that any woman in the world is treated like this. It's absurd." And so he and I became great friends.
That is so cool.
Lifetime
I love
friends,
that.
All of these guys.
So after this, again, you're getting these, AAU is banning women from all competitions with male runners, the violators losing the right to compete in any races. So basically, are they saying that if the men run with the women, they're at risk as well?
Of course.
I love it. That's wild.
That's how people control people. Saying, I know you may be sympathetic with her, but if you are in the same race with her, you damage your AAU eligibility. And,
wow,
of course, getting kicked out of the AAU in those days was like getting excommunicated from the church.
Exactly.
You know, you didn't have any choice. And if you were a top athlete and you wanted to compete in national competitions or go on to the Olympics, you were scared of the AAU. You know, all of us were, because they just had us like with an iron fist. You know, and of course, you know, those are the days of under-the-table payments. How is a top Olympic athlete supposed to earn a living, right? Well, you know, they're supposed to go to work, get a job, have a family, and train their brains out, and then make the Olympic team. And that you know, that's what amateur status is all about. Well, you know, if these people were training so hard and trying to represent their countries, and so if a shoe company gave them money, if they were ever found out about that, they would have definitely been excommunicated, you know, definitely thrown out. I mean, there were really very sad stories. One of our best milers in history, is worth reading, a guy by the name of Wes Santee.
Yeah,
I mean, the
journalists
set him up. They set him up. He ran a race, and he received a camera as one of his prizes.
Yep.
And the camera was deemed to be worth then $20. And since it was like a, let's say, a $40 camera, he was a professional, and they reported it and had him you know, banned from further competition. Mm-hmm. And here was a guy who feasibly could have been one of the first men. It could have been Wes Santee and not Roger Bannister, under 4 minutes of the mile.
Well, and it's funny because what it is the AAU was protecting themselves, right? They were the ones making money,
of course,
and the athletes weren't.
But the journalists set him up,
right,
with the AAU. And why take your great champion? Well, because they wanted a scandal story. In other words, a scandal story is a lot more interesting than a big success story. Wonderful West Santee farm boy is going to break the 4 minute mile. You know, it breaks your heart.
It really does.
So
when you look at your running career, you won the New York City Marathon in 74, run 3:07:29. PR for Boston, PR is 2:51:37 at the 75 Boston. Female runner of the decade from Runner's World. It's funny how a lot of times people who start out as sort of bandits and we need to stay away from this person all of a sudden become celebrated. Did that surprise you, going from people questioning why you were doing something to honoring you for doing something?
Well, of course, it took a very, very long time.
It did.
I mean, a long time. You know, and I had a major chip on my shoulder when I finished the Boston Marathon. The first one was 4:20. And Jock Semple goes to the newspaper the next day and said, not only is she a fraud and an imposter, she, you know, ran so slowly, he said, I could have walked it that fast.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I said, well, I don't think 4:20 is bad for a first marathon with a gorilla on your back.
Exactly.
You know? And anyway, so I had a major chip on my shoulder. I was also, as I always am, physiologically curious, and I began training very hard. And I often tell people, if I can go from 4:20 to 2:51, anybody can do it if they're willing to work hard, because I'm not talented. But what that showed me is how much talent really exists out there. So, I mean, I also wanted to earn my credibility as an athlete, and now people who put me down as an athlete, and many did, many still do. It's hilarious. Back in Boston, people say, well, your first marathon was only 4:20.
running for your life and worrying that someone was going to pull you off the course.
Old, people still do that.
And let's face it, you also weren't wearing the most aerodynamic or the best running.
It was
a sweatshirt
cool.
you were wearing? What were you wearing?
I was wearing a, well, underneath I had on really cute shorts and top, and I really did want to kind of show off because, it, you know, up to that point, you know, there a lot of women in running, a lot of women in sports didn't show they were so masculine looking
yes.
that it upset other women, and that's one reason why women were afraid to get in sports, because they were afraid they'd turn into guys. And of course, there were no shoes or clothing or role models and stuff like that. So I had this really cute shorts and top on, but the day was like 35 degrees with a headwind and sleet and snow and rain. It was utterly miserable. All of us, you know, we looked like refugees. We were just, everybody just wore everything they had on, you know. And of course, that was another good thing, because what if I had on that shorts and T-shirt? Shorts and top at the start, I might have been...
They would have pulled you right away.
Pulled on a hot sunny day.
No question. And in fact, the fact it was rainy, right, didn't that help getting past the security guys who were looking for race numbers at the beginning?
Well, we all pulled up our sweatshirts, and they checked off our bibs as we went in, but they were in a hurry because the weather was so bad, everything was running late.
Right.
And in those days, they started the race bang on noon.
Oh, yeah.
Because all the watches and clocks had to start at noon. In those days, we didn't have... fancy damn stopwatches.
Oh, that's true. That is true.
Yeah, we pull the stem out of the watch and set it at noon, and when the gun went off, you push the stem in. That's how you calculated your time.
So, like we mentioned, there were so few opportunities for women, especially in running, to be there and be the commentator for the first Olympic marathon for women, for being able to watch Joan Benoit from the U.S. win that. Was that emotional for you? Because you were one of the ringleaders of this movement, and to see that the Olympics was opening their door to, because they had the same thing: women can't run a marathon, they can't run the Olympic marathon, and next thing you know, the women are kicking butt and taking names.
Well, there's a whole backstory to
yeah.
this too, Bob, and that is once we got women official in Boston. And there were a whole group of us that worked very hard to make that happen, and it took 5 years. Then we organized, Nita Cusick and I and Fred Lebo in New York, organized the first ever women's road race in Central Park, which was 10Ks. And when 78 women showed up, which was massive in
yes.
those days, that's when I knew it was going to be the idea of a series of women's only races would be the thing that would entice and not only entice, but inspire
right.
women to come and run.
Mm-hmm.
Because women were still very, very intimidated about starting to run. And you put that together with a series of how-to-run clinics. And I took the program to Avon Cosmetics at the
yes,
time.
Yes, the Avon Running Series.
Me.
Yep.
And so what we did is organized eventually 400 of these races in 27
countries. Oh, my God. I didn't know 400
yeah,
races.
Yeah,
wow.
That was my job. That's when after I ran that really great Boston... Then I really began this career, and I was sad to give up, you know, hard running. On the other hand, I was always more entranced with social change
sure.
and creating events than running myself. So eventually, let me just say that within 5 years, you know, we had data to convince the International Olympic Committee that women's marathon should be in the Olympic Games. And I got to tell you, from country to country and athletic to athletic federation, they thought I was smoking poppy.
Really?
Because, you know, I would go to them. I'm saying, we're going to put on this race. We're trying to get the women's marathon in the Olympic Games. Going to countries like Malaysia, Philippines, Brazil, they didn't even have a women's sports event, much less organized road race, you know?
But you needed them. You needed to have a consortium of countries,
votes.
Right?
Yeah, and we got them. You know, we needed active participation in 24 countries and 3 continents, and I had 27 countries and 5 continents. So you can't ignore that. And then we had people like Dr. David Martin
yes.
Help us with the medical statistics
yep.
because still there was the myth that, you know, your uterus was going to fall out if you ran. And he showed that women were inherently, and this is what's changing the face of sports today, women were better at endurance and stamina than men. And that the shot putter, the 400 meters, was not at all ideal for women, but the marathon, and even longer, would be ideal for them. And, of course, that's bearing out. Women are winning 100-mile races, 6-day races, 24-hour runs in mixed competition all the time now.
Well, and we're seeing that in, you know, in triathlon. Back in 1988, Paul Newby Fraser was 11th
absolutely.
Overall.
When, absolutely.
You know,
absolutely.
The longer it goes...
Yeah.
The better it is for people who can handle the distance.
Absolutely. So So the future of sport is very exciting for me right now. I mean, when we look at the next 50 years, now that we've overcome so many of the social obstacles and cultural ones, and the fear ones, you know, we can move ahead a lot. But to answer your question, sure. When I was then asked to do the commentary of that first women's Olympic marathon, it was very emotional for me. But I was trying to keep it in rein because I knew every woman in that race. You know, they'd run in my
sure.
A-mon program. And I didn't root any harder, frankly, for Joan Benoit than I was for Greta Weiss or Rosa Moda or Lorraine Muller. You know,
right?
They were all women who were believers and movers and shakers in making this event the historic event it was. Having said that, I was certainly delighted to see Joan come across the finish line in one of the classic races. You know, it was a classic race of risk and determination. You know, amazing.
When we look back and we say, you know, the first running boom was Frank Shorter winning the Olympic gold in 72. And when I look at the creation of the Rock and Roll Marathon Series in 1998 and the fact that a lot of those races are 60, 65, sometimes 70% women, do you look at those events, and I know you're going to be at Rock and Roll San Antonio fairly soon, do you look at those races and go, see, sort of told you this is what's going to happen?
Yeah. I always said when the women were coming out for these races, I'm saying this isn't about running, it's about a social revolution. Because they're not, most of these women are not running to lose 5 pounds anymore, like they always used to say, or they're not running to become Olympic athletes. They're running because it makes them feel good about themselves.
Right. And the charity component. The charity component,
yeah,
I think, has been huge.
Well, that makes them feel good about themselves.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's more than them. But also, you know, everybody's busy. Everybody's time constrained. But a woman who's got 2 or 3 kids, the dog in the house, and she's got a job, and his husband's got a job. That house is moving and shaking every morning and every evening. And she somehow gets out and runs her 20 minutes or 30 minutes in the morning. And that's her moment, you know, that where she can just center herself, bust a little stress, get a perspective, and feel full of self-esteem. And that self-esteem then becomes a sense of fearlessness. And these women go on for the rest of the day, say, I can do it. No matter what happens in my crappy day, I've just, you know, done something wonderful that, you know, is more important than all the other stuff. And it works. To the point where, let me just jump ahead because
sure.
I want to make sure I tell this story.
Yes.
Where now, with, you know, there are more women runners, of course, in the USA and in Canada. I believe we're getting close in France and also Japan, amazingly enough. Because of the sense of self-esteem. But then you have to look at the rest of the world, many countries of whom don't even let their women go out of the door alone, get a passport, drive a car,
right.
Get an education. I mean, and of course, the women themselves, they don't have a real choice with this, but they don't question it because that's the way it's always been. And I say that most of the women in the world still now, unfortunately, live in a fearful situation. And she could be in Afghanistan, or she might be her next-door neighbor. You know what I mean? Once you're in the fear box, you always stay with the devil you know rather than the devil you don't know because it's less scary.
Sure.
Even though it may be abysmal. But the women who run have moved out of that. What's happened that has been so phenomenal, and really, I could never in a million years have predicted this, but my bib number that Jock Semple tried to rip off of me, in 1967, which was number 261,
yep.
Has become a number meaning fearless in the face of adversity. And this happened totally organically. People were sending me pictures of them wearing 261 on their back, inking it on their arm, tattooing it. And they said the same thing, each one. It makes me feel fearless. And so we've created a nonprofit called 261 Fearless, and we take that sense of empowerment from running into local community clubs around the world. And we're going into those countries and those communities and getting women together to talk to each other and creating a network where, thanks to the Internet, they actually can talk to each other, but through their own communities they share that sense of empowerment and they become fearless. And so, you know, you change women, you're going to change the world. And it's, you know, we've seen what running has already done for women in Kenya and Ethiopia. Just imagine when we start getting into other places like the Mideast, it's going to be quite amazing. And everybody laughs again, thinks I'm crazy. But it's worked before, and it'll work again.
No question.
It absolutely will.
So later on, what was the relationship like, or was there one, with Jock Semple or with Will Cloney? Were they ever become sort of understanding that, you know what, we worked this, you took us kicking and screaming into something we didn't want to do, but it was a good thing?
They never quite said it that way.
Yeah.
But they became my very, very dear friends.
They did. Very interesting.
Very dear friends. Jock Semple and I became buds. We would do speeches together, helped him launch his book. I was with him just a few hours before he died. And, you know, people say, whoa, that's a lot of forgiveness. Well, first of all, he's a man who finally did come around
right. To
believing in women's running. He didn't like it at first when we were official in Boston, but he came around to seeing suddenly, now that we were official, he said, gee, they run pretty well. Like, no kidding. But anyway, it doesn't matter. How can you not love somebody who, even though it was the worst thing in your life at the time, changed your life in such an amazing, wonderful way?
Yes.
Because he inspired you.
Yes.
And also, he he gave the world one of the most galvanizing photos in women's rights history.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, he changed everything. It
changed everything.
If the photographers weren't there to capture that moment, does women's running get to where it's at now? I question that.
Yep, exactly. Eventually, yes, because empowerment is a very powerful thing, and people would discover that. But that expedited it. The other thing, Will Cloney, he and I also very, very good friends. He was a much more measured man, and I taped him. I taped him a lot for my book. Got a lot of oral history. And one of the sweetest things, you know, when he passed away, I wrote to his family and was acknowledged and all that stuff. But after Boston this year, I got an email from his daughter, who is, you know, is probably like my age now.
Right,
you know, and she said, you know, we've followed you throughout your whole career, and what a wonderful thing. She said, I think my dad up in heaven is probably clapping the loudest as you cross that finish line 50 years later, which was great, you know?
And how was that? You're wearing 261. You're at the 50th anniversary of your first Boston. You run 444. It must have been a wonderful parade lap for you, just running, just being out there and being celebrated.
You know, it was. It was unbelievable. But I have to tell you, when I walked to the starting line, my legs felt like cooked spaghetti because I'd had so many media interviews.
Yes.
I hadn't been able to sleep with the stress because, you know, we had 125 people running on our 261 team. There was so much pressure. You know, it was effectively the global launch of the foundation, 261 Fearless. We wanted everything to go well. And I thought, I'm not sure I can actually finish this race. I feel horrible. And actually, once we got moving, all of a sudden, you know, the body just lets running take over, and the stress fell away, and I said, I'm going to enjoy this. And I started looking and waving at people and hugging babies along the way, and hundreds of people had signs out cheering me and 261 and women. It was phenomenal. It was every mile got better, and I stopped 13 times walking through water stations or hugging people, and I did 8 interviews, and still, my time was only 24 minutes slower than it was
50 years ago.
Yeah. So isn't the body amazing?
It really
is.
And
I had this great sense of gratitude when I came across the finish line, not only for good health, active aging, optimism, all those things, but also passing the torch for the great accomplishments of the last 50 years to all of you out there who are going to take it forward for the next 50 years. I'm not going to be around in 50 years.
Yeah, but you never know.
Never know. But when you look at the accomplishments, just ask everybody to imagine what the next 50 years are going to look like. When now we have the scientific data, we have so much progress made, and we're realizing what capability is all about, both in males and females.
So yeah, then you just ran New York, 448.
I just ran New York.
Yeah.
In the moment of runner delusional hypoxia after Boston, I made this decision, hey, I'm in great shape, I might as well run New York. And I didn't bother to think that maybe Boston was just a happy fluke, you know, maybe God was like on your side for a few hours. I decided to run New York, and New York was the same thing. It, you know, I was nervous going into it, of course, but lot less pressure. This was for fun, and it was my first time through the five boroughs. Even winning in 74, it was all in Central Park.
That's right,
so
yes.
This time I got to, after being on the back of a motorcycle for 28 years through the streets of New York, this time I actually got to run them, and it was so much fun.
This was
and
your
again,
first New York
that
you
was
ran?
My first New York
since
the streets.
Wow!
But I've been, but see, I'd done the TV commentary for 28 years. I knew those neighborhoods very, very well, and alongside of the elite women. So here I was in the midst of the rabble, if you see what I mean.
Exactly.
You know?
The other thing that that's always fascinating, if we look at why running has become so hot, everything comes down to dollars. At the end of the day, when people realized, hey, this rock and roll event comes to San Antonio or comes to Arizona and there's 35,000 people and they're filling up 120,000 hotel nights, that's real business. And these cities need real business. They need the dollars. And what's happening is you've got, like we said, 60, 65, 70% of the field is women. And that changes the face of these expos. Back in the day, if I was going to an expo, I'd try to get in there and be out in 5 seconds. Well, all of a sudden, when you've got 65% of the field being women and coming to the expo, there's a little shopping going on. It's the dollars, I think, have made a significant impact on, you know, running has become so successful because the people realize there's big business there.
Yeah, but you know what? So what? I think that's great. And, you know, I have to laugh, of course, when it comes to genetic superiority in sports. Women can outshop men any day of the week. There's no question about it. But look, the reason why they're buying things with running is because anybody in this world is going to buy something that makes them feel a little more empowered, a little stronger, a little more powerful. People find the money to spend for things that are very important. Remember with the big economic crash in early 2000, the great, maybe you weren't around, but that was devastating. Everything suffered. People were losing their jobs. Guys were out on the street with their boxes from their office. People, women, men and women both. But you know what? They showed up at Boston. They showed up in New York. You know why? Because that's the thing that gave them their biggest sense of self. So I don't mind anything becoming professionalized if it's done well. And is running getting too expensive and outpricing itself? Well, for everything that if that's the case, then there will be things that are created that are less expensive. You know, Park Run, free, is catching on. But, I mean, let's take Rock and Roll San Antonio, because I love the rock and roll events, and I love how they busted through and helped create this fun, amazing atmosphere where it's not about having to be fast and competitive. It's just about doing it, completing it, taking care of your health, enjoying being empowered. And San Antonio in particular, I'm really looking forward to, because I love the city manager there. Her name is Cheryl Scully, and is she a pistol? She came over on as the city manager just at the time San Antonio was named the fattest city, most unhealthy, fattest city in America. She said, we got to do something about this, and called up Rock and Roll and said, we got to get a marathon here. And it changed the face of the city.
Yes, it did.
You see? And my husband, Roger Robinson, probably the greatest, I think, writer, or certainly historian on running, said, where else in the world do you see 50,000, 20,000, 30,000 people going through the streets of a city that's not an army?
That's
you
true.
Know,
that's
it's
true.
Running has changed the face of our cities. It's wholly a force for good. And that is one of the best things. New York City, the crime rate is at its lowest on Marathon Day.
That's so cool. So what will you in San Antonio? Will you be running? What will you be doing there?
In San Antonio, I'm going to, I may be withdrawing a little bit from this promise. I want to run the 5K on Saturday. I want to run the half marathon on Sunday. We have a team of 261 runners there. Cheryl, I think, has promised to run at least the 5K with me. We'll jog
through
that. Yeah, cool. I just adore her. And really, I love that city. I think it's one of the most beautiful cities in America. And I love the fact that it is kind of one of the crown jewels of the rock and roll series. And I'm really looking forward to being there, representing Humana also. This is another thing I'm excited about. It's a Humana title-sponsored race. Humana, the health insurance company, and I have partnered in trying to reach out to people to say active aging is the way to go. It's the way to be optimistic, live longer, live better, live more healthily, and that you should park those sneakers by the door and go out for a 10-minute walk, and if you can get up to a marathon, that's great. You don't have to run a marathon, but, you know, we're on the verge, Bob, of another frontier, and that's aging. People talk about me at 70 the way they talked about women 50 years ago. You should take it easy.
No.
You should slow down.
Don't ever take it easy. No.
You might have a heart attack. You might hurt yourself. That's the way they talk to old people.
Yes, they did.
They do.
Yep.
That's the way they talk to women 50 years ago.
And what's happened is, because I'm in the what we call the 65 to death category, and I race basically every weekend. I think I did 40 triathlons and a couple marathons stuff last year. And the key is that it's just fun. And by being with young people at these events, it keeps us young. It's the best thing ever.
Well, you know, people said to me, I can't believe you're doing this at 70. And my first reaction was, I'm not 70. I'm only 25.
Exactly. Exactly. We get a photo every week at the triathlons with all of our guys in the 65 to death category. And we get a photo. And people say, well, why do you guys still do it? It's because we can, right? That's why we're there. We love it. We love going out and you're swimming, you're cycling, you're running. That's probably one of the things that I'm a big proponent of is I think it's difficult as you age to continue running the type of mileage that people ran when they're younger. And if they incorporate a little swimming, a little spin class, a little cycling, they can run less and run forever.
Yeah. And the other, I mean, of course, you change your whole strategy. I mean, you know, when I was running a 251 marathon, I was training 13 workouts a week.
Wow.
Run 10K every morning, and the only morning I didn't run 10K was the morning I got up and ran, you know, 20 or 25 miles on Sunday or race. And it was 110 miles a week. Now, when I'm getting ready for Boston last April, I decided, since the science has changed a lot, that I would go get some help from a physio and see what she said. Mm-hmm. And she said, basically, you should run every other day.
Yes.
What? You got to be kidding me. But what I did is I had quality runs, and then I could recover.
Exactly.
You know? It was really good.
Well, and actually, I remember when Rod Dixon was trying to break the four-minute mile for even Coughlin ended up doing at the age of 40. He said that he could do the same workouts he did when he was 25, but he needed more time off in between. He needed more recovery.
That's right.
That's really what it comes down to.
Basically the same quality, but, you know, relative to your age, of course, but then the recovery. It's really important.
And do you do any cross training, any workouts in the gym?
Yeah, on the opposite days, I work on my core, and I joked, I said, I used to have a great core, but I lost it somewhere along the way. And it's hilarious. Also, I had to get some professional help with this. You know, my old sit-ups and things like that are apparently obsolete and have to do these planks and different things.
Yes.
But you know what made all the difference in the world? I'm much more upright. I'm much more easy. It's much easier for me to do speed work now. It's terrific.
I love it. And Catherine, what besides the Rock and Roll San Antonio, you're speaking. You've got your charity. You sound like you're busier now than you've ever been.
I am. It's amazing. I am busier now than I've ever been, and that's not quite the way I want it to be. But it's 261 Fearless. That I really want to get a good, solid global launch, pass that legacy onto these younger women. I could still be the voice of it until I drop. But also, hey, listen, there are opportunities out there to reach whole publics, particularly the old aging public, to encourage them to keep healthy their whole lives, and also to encourage everyone, you know, that, hey, look at this 50-year story. You can do so much more than you ever imagined. You know, don't underestimate yourself. Get out there. Put another foot in front of the other.
I love it. Catherine, it has been way too long. It's so nice to finally get to chat with you. Congratulations on everything you've done. You've helped take women's running to another stratosphere, and obviously there's a lot more to come.
A lot more to come. Watch this space, and thank you, Bob. Thank you so much for calling.
Again,
see you in San Antonio.
Yes, we'll see you in San Antonio again. We are brought to you by Tough Man Triathlon, VeloFix.com, RunCatalina.com, ATV Swim Spas, the official training vessel of six-time Ironman World Champion Dave Scott. Our Challenge Athletes Foundation, DonateCAF.org. This last year, we sent out 2,448 grants, totaling $3.7 million. Check out any of our interviews on Babbittville.com and on iTunes. And until next time, remember, endurance lives here.